She didn't want to be friends with the mom equivalents of Cody Campbell and Amber Bitburger. But unlike Deming, Kay had no friends, aside from her and Peter's co-workers at Carlo. At least he had Roland. Instead of friends, Kay and Peter had books they read in bed at night. They left articles for each other, clipped out of news magazines, on one another's pillow, with underlined paragraphs and notes in the margins. "Think you'd like this. Thought about you. Did you know?" The tall shelves in the living room were stuffed with hardcover books on subjects like war and economics and the Electoral College. The most intriguing thing in the house was the stereo system from Peter's brief bachelor days, with mustard-yellow speakers, a silver hi-fi tuner, and the crowning glory, a record player with a turntable wrapped in a soft cloth. The cabinet below the record player housed a small record collection, along with an eraser-like object used to clean the records. One afternoon, Deming was at home by himself. He knelt in front of the stereo, and, simultaneously daring himself and accepting the dare, pushed the cabinet door open. The records' covers were throbbing and bright, bands he'd never heard of, and inside the cardboard pockets were hard black discs, slick and coated, with circular rings. What alien trees might be like if you sliced their trunks open. When he saw Peter's car pull into the driveway, Deming closed the cabinet. Peter put his bag down on the couch.
"How was school today, Daniel?"
Deming got up from the floor.
"It was fine."
"Why don't you choose a record and we can listen to it?"
Conscious of Peter watching him, Deming opened the cabinet again. He took out the record he had been looking at. Jimi Hendrix's "Are You Experienced?" The words written in a psychedelic leer, as if the letters had fingers and feet. On the cover was a picture of a black man standing with two white men.
"Hold it by the edges. You don't want to scratch the surface."
Peter lifted the lid of the record player. Deming set the disc down, and slowly, the record spun, the needle lowering itself with a resolute crackle. Peter turned the volume knob up in one circular motion. Then came the opening notes. The music filled the room with color, a punch with a grin. Deming hovered by the speaker. Peter twisted the volume knob higher, and they stood there, basking in sound.
"What?"
Kay held her car keys, the front door open, and Deming felt a breeze stream into the house, as if the guitars were fanning him.
"It's really loud," she said.
Peter turned the volume down, and when Kay left the room, he said to Deming,
"Your mother doesn't appreciate music the way we do."
On Peter's old headphones, puffy, silver, with a curly black cord, Deming listened to "Are You Experienced?" after school, lying on the living room floor. He counted the heartbeats during that little catch between songs, savoring the delicious itch as the needle dropped and the melody snuck its toe out from behind a curtain. The disc of a record was hardier yet more delicate than plasticky CDs. A record was to be treasured. Its circle scratches a mysterious language, a furtive tattoo. Deming walked the hallways of Ridgeboro Middle with lyrics scrolling mad loops in his mind. "Hey, Joe. Where you going with that gun in your hand?" He translated the lines into Fujonese and snickered as the other kids gawked. He repeated the line in Mandarin as a group of eighth graders passed, looked at one another, and said,
"What the?"
Headphones delivered shapes and notes directly to his bloodstream. A drumbeat's taut assault gave him a semi-boner. How he had missed music! How he craved it! The city had been one long song, vivid, endlessly shading. A massive dance mix of bus beats, train drums, and passing stereos. And in Ridgeboro, its absence was flagrant. Before he found the records, he would turn up the little clock radio in his room and point it toward the window to receive weak signals from a station that played scratchy techno music and another that played scratchy Spanish music. But the reception was spotty and the songs flashed in and out. In Ridgeboro, there wasn't enough sound to produce any colors but the weakest, haziest ones. Peter gave him a pair of tiny earbuds and burned a couple CDs. Kay gave him her old Discman and a pack of batteries. Deming preferred Peter's old headphones because they were a bigger buffer to the world. The blank streets and large trees became comical when paired with the soundtrack. Made him an action hero instead of an abandoned boy. And Planet Ridgeboro blew up. Platinum flowers morphed into oscillating lines and dancing triangles. Electric blue snare drums punctuated a chocolate bass line, topped with sticky orange guitar. Turquoise vocals whipped into a thick, buttery frosting. He played and replayed, played and replayed. As he walked down Oak Street, he shut his eyes and pretended he was in the city with his mother. She looked like him. He looked like her. They looked like the other people they saw on the streets and trains. In the city, he had been just another kid. He had never known how exhausting it was to be conspicuous. He came home from school the next day expecting to find the house empty as usual. But when he unlocked the door, he heard voices. Kay was in the living room with the television on, scooping apple slices into a jar of peanut butter. The TV played a soap opera. An older woman scolding a younger woman in front of a window overlooking a beach. "Television stunts development," Deming said. He'd heard her and Peter say it before. "At least someone's been listening to me, unlike my undergraduates. I couldn't handle office hours today, so I played hooky. Don't tell anyone." Kay patted the couch. "Look. These women are about to find out that they're married to the same man. Come watch with me. Eat apple slices and peanut butter. We'll stunt our brains together and become a pair of blathering idiots." Deming settled in, luxuriating in the noise. Jaunty keyboards on detergent commercials bathed him in rainbow waves. The couch was a forest green plaid, its cushions smooth and shiny. "How's school?"
"Okay."
"I'm going to talk to that Mrs. Lumpkin about getting you extra help in math. After dinner, let's go over your homework."
"I hate math," Deming said.
"It's not that hard. I know you can do it. You need to get over that mental block. The one that says, 'I hate math, I'm not good at it.'"
"But I hate it and I'm not good at it."
Kay picked up the peanut butter and angled her apple slice inside, scraping the sides of the plastic. "My mother believed girls were naturally bad at math. Bad at school, even. She still doesn't really understand what I do. My father was more encouraging, but they assumed your Uncle Gary would be the one to go to college and work a respectable profession, like in accounting or pharmacy. But Gary barely graduated from high school. Now he works in a Home Depot outside of Syracuse. That's the city I grew up in. We'll go there for Thanksgiving. He's been divorced twice."
"What's a Home Depot?"
"It's a big store, where you buy tools. And wood." She crunched her apple. "They were hard on Gary.
Hard on both of us.
You know, your father had it hard, too. He had a lot of pressure put on him at a young age. His father was a respected lawyer who wanted him to take over his law practice. Your father wanted to travel more. See the world. He got a scholarship to go to UC Berkeley, out in California. But his parents didn't let him go. They said he had to go to Dartmouth, because that was where his father went. His only rebellion was to go into academia, instead of law. His father never forgave him for that. Kay recrossed her feet, right over left. Anyway, I guess what I'm saying is that you might have internalized... I mean, you might have been told that you aren't good at math. Or even that you aren't good at school. So you need to tell yourself, self, that's not true. Dumming scooped a wad of peanut butter with his index finger. The soap opera switched to a commercial with bright, arching music. Two children and their parents dashing toward a castle. Giant animals and adults dressed like dolls skipping alongside them. Disney World, the screen said. The Magic Kingdom. Orlando, Florida. The peanut butter dangled from his finger as he gaped at the screen. His mother had wanted to take him to Disney World. "Do you want to go there?" Kay asked. She could be looking at this castle right now. Tommy at her side. "No," he said. "It's stupid." Well, thank God. By October, he was a quarter of an inch taller since August, according to the growth chart Kay was marking with a pencil on the dining room wall. When he looked in the mirror, his jawline seemed more pronounced, his eyebrows bushier. He didn't know if his face was still echoed in Mama's. He had no pictures of her. No evidence. Roland's mother, Ms. Licio, worked at Carlo too, in human resources, a phrase that confused Dumming. She would leave out Food Lion brand cookies and jugs of fruit juice for Roland and him. They could have watched 300 channels of cable TV at Roland's house, but instead they played Grand Theft Auto 2. After Dumming showed Roland his Discman and headphones and played him Hendrix, Grand Theft Auto was abandoned. They spent a month of Sundays listening to a shoebox of cassette tapes that the deceased Roland Fuentes, Sr., had left behind. In Roland's room, they rewound his father's life on an old tape player, debated whether they'd rather sing or play guitar, and which was better, Ozzy Solo or Black Sabbath. Ever the classicist, Dumming was Sabbath all the way. Roland's parents were in their early 20s when he was born. They had met in college, moved to D.C. and Montreal, and somehow ended up in Ridgeboro. And Roland and Dumming listened to tapes of Adamant, the Ramones, the Clash, AC/DC, Van Halen, the Pixies, New Order, Jane's Addiction. From there it was hours of web searching for related bands. Each song was theirs to discover. They had been previously schooled in nothing. "That's so green," Dumming said, as they listened to a mixtape Roland's mother had made for Roland's father before Roland was born, with a collaged cover of magazine cutouts and a label that said, "High Life."
"Yeah," Roland said. "So neat."
"No, green. The guitar is the color of grass." Never had there been a time when sound, color, and feeling hadn't been intertwined. When a dirty, rolling bass line hadn't induced violets that suffused him with thick contentment. When the shades of certain chords sliding up to one another hadn't produced dusty pastels that made him feel like he was cupping a tiny golden bird. It wasn't just music, but also rumbling trains and rainstorms, occasional voices, a collective din. Colors and textures appeared in front of him, bouncing in time to the rhythm. Or he'd get a flash of color in his mind, an automatic sensation of a tone, innate as breathing. The candy red of a Wurlitzer organ made him want to retch, yet it repulsed him to even consider the possibility of it being any other color. A particularly nefarious jingle for a used car dealer produced the most evil clash of greens. And there'd been one summer when he couldn't even turn on the TV, afraid the jingle would be ready to pounce. A two-line refrain he heard from a boombox on Fordham Road recreated the lapping blues of the river in Minjiang so completely that it would haunt him for years. until he tracked down the song and listened to it until it grew thin. He would learn how to create music, matching tones to shades to feelings and translating them back to melody. The purest and most inept form of communication. He'd craft songs that conveyed exactly what he wanted to say, yet he was the only one who could understand them. The rest of the world heard only sound. His efforts would always fall flat. The gift would always be his. Dumming chased after music with a hunger that bordered on desperation. Why didn't other people have the same need? How could Kay prefer the low, modulated voices of NPR in the car when she could as easily choose to blast the blowout world of Hendrix, or the bright angles of Prince, or the sun glare of Bowie? Water, Dumming would see when he listened to Sound and Vision. Water, water, water. When he was a grown-up with his own car, he'd never be so boring. Binge listening to a good song was better than binge eating a bag of Hershey's miniatures in the pattern of Mr. Goodbar, Milk Chocolate, Crackle, Special Dark. There had been one glorious, motherless Bronx afternoon when he and Michael had done exactly that. Music was a language of its own, and soon it would become his third language. A half-diminished seventh to a major seventh to a minor seventh, as pinchy sweet as flipping between Chinese tones. American English was loose major fifths, Fujonese angled sevenths and ninths. He made up band names on his walks home, sketched out their album covers and song lyrics. The Toilet Plungers, Floaters or Flushers, Dumpkin and More, I Shot the Food Lion, Necromania, Brains on a Spike. Roland, delighted when Dumming showed him the list, scribbled the fake band names onto the fronts of his notebooks, and when other kids asked about them, he would feign shock and say,
"You don't know that band?"
They'd shake their heads.
"Hey, Daniel, you get that new Necromania album yet? I like that first track, Brains on a Spike."
In the middle of the hallway, around the corner from Principal Chester's office, Roland belted out the lyrics Dumming had written.
"Brains on a spike! Yum yum burp! Heart on a spike! Damn, that hurt!"
Dumming wanted to correct Roland. It was heart on a knife, not spike.
"I heard they're playing at the Dunkin' Donuts next month,"
Roland said aloud, to no one in particular.
"Necromania! I'm getting tickets. Don't want it to sell out."
Cody Campbell, who played soccer with Roland, came up to Dumming in homeroom and said,
"I heard about the band you're in. Roland's band. Necro... Mania."
"That's my band, not Roland's," Dumming said. "I started it."
In November, Peter and Kay asked Dumming what he wanted for a birthday gift.
"An electric guitar," he said.
On the morning of his 12th birthday, he awoke to find an index card on his bedside table, with a note in Peter's handwriting.
"It's time to play some Hendrix."
"It's a treasure hunt,"
Peter said, clapping his hands together.
"You go to the place you think is being referred to on the card in order to find the next clue, and so on. The clues lead to your birthday gift."
"It's a Wilkinson tradition," Kay said. "Every year on our birthdays, we make treasure hunts for one another. On my last birthday, your father set up clues that led to a restaurant near Syracuse. Now it's your turn."
Dumming went downstairs and lifted the lid of the record player. On the turntable was another card that said, "What word comes after surprise, alphabetically?" He took the dictionary down from the bookshelf, flipped through the pages until the next card fell out. After being led to the linen closet, the china cabinet, and the dishwasher, he found a clue that said, "Put your socks away," to the hamper, and opened it to find a box wrapped in silver paper, topped with a plastic bow. It was a big box,
but not big enough for a guitar. He brought it to his bedroom.
"Open it!"
Peter cried. It was a new laptop, white and glimmering. "All yours." Kay kissed him on the cheek. "Happy birthday, Daniel." Deming pierced the plastic wrapping with his fingernail. The plastic clung to the cardboard, then slowly unfurled. He opened the box, lifted the lid of the computer, and plugged it in, wishing that Michael could be there so they could watch videos together, wanting to show it all to Michael. The laptop, the records, the tapes, the Discman, the town full of white people. Where was Michael? Why wasn't he here? It was Roland he invited to his birthday dinner with Peter and Kay, at Casa Margarita in the strip mall on the highway, where they ate fajitas and drank virgin margaritas with paper umbrellas tucked in the slush. The waiters led the room in singing, and Deming blew out the candles on his ice cream cake. When Roland saw the laptop, he whispered, with a reverence that made Deming proud, "Your parents are cool." As long as he didn't think about his mother, Deming was not that unhappy in Ridgeboro. Yet there was always this nagging, icy swipe of fear, a reminder that he needed to stay alert. At times the fear was so far in retreat he forgot its existence. At other times it was so strong he could barely stop himself from shrieking. These people were strangers. He couldn't trust them. Like when a Chinese maid had appeared on a TV show. A woman in a tight dress with garish eye makeup speaking a botched version of Mandarin. And Kay had stopped talking. The silence in the room was so loud it formed a dark red curtain. And Kay had flushed and quickly changed the channel, blabbing about winter and skiing as the TV played a commercial with a blonde lady putting a plate of fish steaks in a microwave. If Leon or Mama or Vivian had been there, they would have all laughed at the Chinese maid together. Made a joke about what province she was from. How could they get a job like that? Or the time Kay asked him to run into Food Line and pick up a gallon of milk while she waited in the car, and Deming swore he'd heard someone make a noise like they did in kung fu movies. Hi-ya! When he told Kay about the sound, she had said, "Maybe you misheard? Maybe they were singing a song? Or telling a friend about a movie? Or eating shitty Chinese takeout at Roland's house. Gloppy chicken and nuclear red sauce." And Roland had poked at the meat lumps and asked what it was, and his mother joked that it was cat or dog. Was that a tail they saw there? And Deming felt chilled. Implicated. Be careful. They're not on your side. It's important to be strong. "Next year, can I get a guitar?" They were driving home after dinner at Casa Margarita, after dropping Roland off. If he had a guitar, he and Roland could have a real band.
"Let's not get carried away,"
Peter said.
"Music is fine to listen to as a hobby, but you need to focus on school."
"But what if my grades get better?"
"You need to be more responsible, Daniel. Don't ask for more when you can't even be thankful for what you already have."
"I am thankful."
Kay turned around. "Enjoy your laptop first. Live in the moment." They were talking in bed again.
"He's getting C's and D's," Peter said. "We should look into a tutor. A student from Carlo."
"That's a good idea," Kay said.
"He needs to work harder."
"Oh, God. Sometimes I look at him and think, what are we doing with this 12-year-old Chinese boy? In Ridgeboro. Jim and Elaine, at least they're in New York City. How could we have considered bringing a child from China here?" "The other day, Daniel told me he'd heard something, I don't know, racist at the Food Lion. I was horrified. And now, whenever we go out, I'm suspicious. Are people looking at us because I have blonde hair and he has black hair? Or is it more nefarious? It's making me paranoid.
We're learning. We're learning.
I mean, should we cook Chinese food? Or start Mandarin lessons again? I don't want to be this, you know, this white lady.
You're not doing anything wrong. It's not easy, caring for a foster child. This has been a big change for us. A big adjustment.
Tell me about it. Some days I want to do one of those marathon riding days like I used to. But then there's this boy here who needs us. And I need to make him meals and buy him clothes and make sure I'm loving and caring and patient so I don't mess him up more than he already is. I'm afraid I'm too old to learn how to be the kind of mother who gives everything up to Mom. Even foster Mom. I'm using Mom as a verb here, in case you can't tell.
Well, if you're too old, then I'm too old too, Peter said. You know, at a meeting the other day, Will Panov said Daniel was lucky to have us, and we were brave to take in an older boy. I told him, we're the ones who are lucky that he's staying with us.
Kay sighed. I know you're trying to be nice, but it's different for men. All those books and articles I read about the whole unrealistic American expectation regarding motherhood, the martyr-like aspect of it. The reality is so much worse than I'd even expected. You get to work all you want, but you never feel bad about it. You weren't brought up that way.
No? I think I know a little about familial expectations.
There was a lengthy silence. Peter finally said,
"This might sound callous, but honestly, whatever we do is going to be better than what he experienced before. You remember what the agency said, how the mother and stepfather both went back to China. We're the first stable home he's ever had."
I know. But I feel like I'm holding my breath. The aunt could still come back. I'll feel so much better when it's all finalized, one way or the other.
We'll know more next month at the hearing.
I want to treat him like he's my own son, not just a foster kid. But there's this chance it won't work out.
Remember, Jamie said it's unlikely there will be an appeal since there hasn't been any communication from his family. And after 6 months, we can start proceedings.
Back to China? Proceedings? Who were Jim and Elaine? If his mother had gone anywhere, it was Florida, not China. In his bedroom, in the dark, Deming held his breath, wondering if they would say more about her, if they knew things about her that he didn't. They were hiding things from him. He'd been right not to trust them. "Did you read that article in the paper today?" Kay said. "An abandoned baby in a bus station in Buffalo?" I'm sure his mother had her reasons. Whatever they were. Mental health. Financial hardship.
All that matters is that we're taking care of Daniel right now, Peter said. Not whether we're Asian or Chinese or whatever.
But do you think we didn't prepare enough? Even if we'd been planning for years.
Oh, we could have read every single book out there and it still wouldn't have prepared us.
I think of his mother constantly, though I probably shouldn't, Kay said. What did she look like? What was her name? It's not like I can ask Daniel about her. He doesn't say a peep. Sure, I know it's cultural. But it's also like he's scared of us.
He won't always be.
I hope so. We'll love him so much we'll make it all better.
Killing them with kindness, that sort of thing.
But no actual killing, Kay said. I'm a pacifist.
Deming waited for them to say more, but they had stopped talking.
Kay was wrong. He wasn't scared of her.
He was scared of finding out what really happened to his mother.
Roland asked outright, said the word that no one else had.
Is it weird being a foster kid? Are the Wilkinsons going to adopt you?
They were walking home from school, down Hillside Road, past the Ridgeboro Library and the Methodist Church, the sidewalk bumpy with tree roots.
Adopt. There was a similar term in Chinese, yet Deming hadn't thought of his time with Peter and Kay to be anything but vaguely temporary, like the stay with Yigong had been vaguely temporary. Even the name Daniel Wilkinson seemed like an outfit he would put on for an unspecified period of time, until he returned to his real name and home planet. Where that real home was, however, was no longer certain.
It's weird, he said.
Do you miss your real mom?
Yeah.
I kind of miss my dad, even if I don't remember him.
They stopped on the corner.
Are you coming over?
I just remembered I have to help my mom with something.
Deming ran the three blocks back to Oak Street. He knew he had a good hour and a half before Kay and Peter came home. He brought his laptop to the study and pulled up an online dictionary. Foster child. A child looked after temporarily or brought up by people other than his or her natural or adoptive parents.
Adoption.
A process whereby a person assumes the parenting for another, and, in so doing, permanently transfers all rights and responsibilities from the original parent or parents. Adoption is intended to effect a permanent change in status, through legal sanction. It took a minute to parse through the language, but when he did, it seemed like the computer was expanding. Temporarily. Permanent. He pulled open the drawer of the file cabinet next to the desk. A long metal arm crammed with folders for taxes, property-related documents, and research for Peter's book on something called free trade. Sandwiched between K-work and life insurance was a fat folder labeled Adoption Foster. Deming tugged until the folder gave way and poured its contents onto the floor. It had to be a joke. He sat on the rug and picked up a color pamphlet titled, Gift of Life. Your child is waiting for you. Blurry pictures of children with large liquid eyes were placed throughout, as well as pictures of adults holding babies with darker skin. The children, the caption said, came from Ethiopia, Romania, and China. The pamphlet talked about how international adoption gave an unwanted child a home and blessed adoptive parents with a child of their own. He dumped out the rest of the folder, listening for sounds downstairs, footsteps or the front door closing. He scanned a printout of an email message, dated more than 4 years ago. Dear Sharon, I attended the Gift of Life informational seminar last Saturday with my husband Peter. After years of unresolved fertility issues, we are very interested in becoming parents. And soon! We've been married for over 20 years and are more than ready to make our family complete. Our loving home in Ridgeboro is ready for a child. We have good friends who are parents to a Chinese adoptee, so we are familiar with the process, and are interested in adopting from China as well. I know there are sending countries that look down on older, first-time parents, Peter and I are each 46. We don't mind adopting a Chinese child who is older, as we know they can also, like us older parents, be harder to place. Peter and I have traveled extensively and both teach at the college level, so we have experience working with young people. We think international adoption would be a good fit for us. I look forward to hearing from you. Sincerely, Catherine S. Wilkinson.
He saw medical records, criminal clearances and background checks, documents stating the Wilkinsons' home was safe for a child, and an email from the Gift of Life director saying that with sending countries new restrictions on international adoption, Kay and Peter might want to consider domestic adoption, or foster to adoption. He flipped through reports from social workers, stating that the Wilkinsons were well-established professionals who were financially and emotionally equipped to become loving parents, and papers that said they had completed mandatory training classes and were court-certified to foster and adopt. When he saw a packet of papers labeled Initial Permanency Hearing Report, in the matter of Deming Guo, he stopped. The report was dated 2 months ago. He had to read a few sentences over twice, but at the end, he understood, even if he wished he didn't.
Birth mother and putative father abandoned child 6 months ago and returned to China. Caregiver V. Zheng signed surrender form. After interim care in Brooklyn, child was placed in foster care with the Wilkinsons, due to K. Wilkinson's indication of Mandarin speaking skills. Foster parents plan to petition for termination of mother's parental rights on grounds of abandonment. No current reunification plan with birth family. Anticipated permanency planning goal. Placement for adoption. There were so many more emails and documents, bundles of legal papers and dense forms, but Deming couldn't bear to read them. And Peter and Kay would be home any minute. He stuffed the papers back into the folder, then wedged the folder in the file cabinet and pushed the drawer shut. Termination. Permanency. His mother had abandoned him. She'd returned to China. He wanted to puke. He closed the browser window. The laptop seemed grotesque. Too big and new. At dinner, he asked them if he was adopted.
"Well, right now we're your foster parents," Kay said.
"That means that you're living with us, like any kid lives with his family, because you need a safe place to stay. And we would like to have you stay with us for as long as you want. We would like to adopt you. Would you like that?"
Deming shrugged.
"It wouldn't happen right away," Peter said. "It might take a long time."
"But what happened to my real family?" Deming asked.
"We are your real family," Peter said.
Kay frowned.
"Your mother wanted to take care of you, but she couldn't."
The table grew blurry. The food tasted dry.
"So she left me."
After he heard Peter and Kay talking in their room the other night, he had been waiting for them to say something to him about his mother. But they kept acting like everything was fine.
"She loved you." Kay refolded her napkin.
"And we love you too."
Peter exchanged a worried look with Kay.
"I saw that,"
Deming said.
"Saw what?"
Peter asked.
"Never mind."
Mama had permanated him. Vivian had lied to him about coming for him soon. His skin burned, and the kitchen lights were so bright, the floorboards were so wide and wooden. The mix on D. Wilk was a single song on loop. A mash-up of abandoned and permanent. He felt faint,
pulled back to the ammoniac odor of the hallways in PS-33. The blue-gray floors and dented metal lockers.
"Daniel, you look tired," Kay said. "Are you okay? Do you want to rest upstairs?"
Deming put one hand on the table to balance himself. Kay pressed her fingers to his forehead.
"Peter, he's really warm. It must be the flu or something. It's been going around at Carlo. Half my students are out sick."
Peter took another bite of his chicken.
"Daniel, go upstairs and rest."
"He can barely stand up," Kay said. "You carry him."
Peter put down his fork and knife. He stood and lifted Deming, one leg, then the other, and carried him up the stairs, grunting with the effort. Deming held his arms around Peter's neck, his legs around Peter's waist. Peter's footsteps were slow and unsure, each step a quiet struggle. 11 in the morning and they had been on the road for almost 5 hours. Peter slammed his hands on the steering wheel when the car came to an abrupt stop on the FDR, idling behind a potato chip truck and a yellow cab. In the back seat, Deming counted exits. None of the highways they had taken from Ridgeboro were familiar, and he skimmed billboards for the furniture one he and Roland especially loved, a store called Sofa King. The Wilkinsons were on their first family road trip to New York City, to visit the Hennings family, who had a daughter Deming's age. Kay said she'd be his friend. "This will be a good trip for your father," Kay had told him. "He needs cheering up." Valerie McClellan had been asked to take over as the chair of Carlo's Department of Economics in the fall, after Will Panov retired. The day Peter found out, Deming had seen him wheeling the plastic garbage bin up from the curb, his face red.
"God damn it!"
he yelled when the bin's wheels caught on a branch in the driveway. Deming tried to remember that first drive upstate with Kay and Peter, 11 months ago, when they were still strangers. First he had looked out the window, trying to memorize the road so he could make his way back. Then he fell asleep. Now they were no longer strangers. They were Kay and Peter, Mom and Dad. And this was the last day he would see them. He had gotten used to having adults speak to him loudly and slowly, as if he was deaf. And it was less terrifying being the only one. The terror had become normal. He no longer fantasized that his mother would come for him. But as they drove deeper into the city, he stared at the looming high-rises with a catch in his throat. Slick pavement, ferocious honking, spewing fire hydrants. Fetid mystery puddles, wet steam expelled through sidewalk gratings as if the earth was panting, firm thwacks of rubber against concrete on handball courts. That precarious dip when you walked over a metal door atop a restaurant basement. It was July. Peter and Kay had filed an adoption petition, and when the judge approved it, they would all go to court to sign the papers. Last month, they had bought Deming a yellow dirt bike and matching helmet, and he and Roland had been biking around town, exploring little streets on the outskirts of Ridgeboro. Still gravel. Still unpaved. With names like Bajor Lane and Meeker Road. Streets he would never see again. Deming had perfected a wheelie on his bicycle. He and Roland had created a stage out of a tree stump, and taken turns jumping off of it into a crowd of invisible fans. He turned away from the window, but when they drove past signs for the Cross Bronx Expressway, turned back. After Kay told him they were going to visit the Hennings, he had called his mother's cell phone for the first time in over a month and got the same message. The call could not be completed. But he'd packed extra clothes. The potato chip truck nudged up.
"Finally," Peter said.
Deming watched the brown buildings fade behind them, breathed a small circle onto the glass and wiped the moisture away with his finger. In front of a gray apartment building on East 21st Street, the sounds and colors came back. The squawk of a lowering bus, the soundtracks of passing cars, house music, an old track with twisting keyboards and words about getting your back up off the wall, a song sung in Spanish with shiny horns and the fattest tuba bass. Bright pastel smudges rapidly filled the sky.
It was hotter here than in Ridgeboro, and Deming turned in a slow, clockwise circle, stricken by the tinkling notes of a nearby ice cream truck, hesitant and plaintive, reminding him of the rainbow sherbet push-pops he would eat with Michael, the sweet liquid that made their tongues blue.
He could hear Michael's quaking laughter, Mama and Vivian snap-talking in Fujianese. A woman on her cell phone bumped him as she walked by, and Deming rubbed his shoulder.
"Excuse me,"
a man said, pushing past. Kay shrank back. A white man with a booming voice and a receding hairline bounded out the front door of the building. He and Peter slapped each other on the backs as if they were trying to dislodge food. Deming had never seen Peter with a friend before, and he liked it.
"This must be Daniel."
The man kissed Kay on the cheek and extended a hand for Deming.
"Jim Hennings."
"Mr. Hennings and I were at school together," Peter said.
"Freshman roommates." "Your father and I always made sure we studied all the time,"
Jim said, and winked. The doorman held open the lobby's glass doors. Deming followed Kay into an elevator as Peter and Jim went to park the car.
20th floor,
the doorman said. Deming pressed the button. The elevator made its journey up and finally opened into a large, sunlit room that smelled of brewing coffee. Empty wine bottles crowded a table, and strung between two walls was a streamer of glittery letters. "Happy Gotcha Day!" He scanned the room. The elevator was the only door he could see, and it dinged when it opened. He would have to wait until everyone was asleep. A girl Deming's age skipped into the room, hair hanging past her armpits, eyes peeking out from behind a blunt fringe of bangs.
"Mom'll be out in a sec."
"Angel, you've grown so much!" Kay bent down and hugged her. To Deming, the girl said,
"I'm Angel Hennings."
She was the first Chinese person he had seen in nearly a year. "Tell Angel your name," Kay said.
"Daniel," said Deming.
A woman padded out in a t-shirt and jeans.
"Kay!"
Her dark, wavy hair was laced with wiry white, and her voice was round and velvety. She reminded Deming of a cartoon cow in a milk commercial. Kay hugged her.
"Elaine, it's so good to see you. And this is Daniel."
Elaine enveloped Deming in a hug. Her hair smelled like apple shampoo.
"Daniel, call me Elaine. What grade are you in? 6th? Like Angel, right?"
7th, Deming said.
7th grade?"
"Going into 7th in the fall," Kay said.
"Ridgeboro Junior High."
Elaine released the hug and studied him at arm's length.
"Junior high already?"
Deming's mouth was dry. He and Roland were supposed to be in the same class in September, but he wasn't sure where he'd be going to school now. The elevator dinged. Deming heard Jim say,
"His English appears more than adequate."
"Like a regular New Yorker," Peter said.
"Peter!"
Angel flung her arms around him.
"Coffee, anyone? I'm blasted from last night. Mommy needs her caffeine fix now."
Elaine walked into the kitchen, still talking.
"Angel was so excited about her Gotcha Day party. So were we, of course, with all that wine.
It's too bad you couldn't make it. I know. We really wanted to,
Kay said.
It would have been a rough drive last night, with all the weekend traffic. But we can have a gotcha day party for Daniel, and you guys can come.
Oh, you must,
Elaine said.
You absolutely must.
Oh, we will,
Kay said, talking like Elaine. Dumming glanced at Angel, but she was bouncing from foot to foot and looking at the gotcha day sign.
Where am I sleeping tonight?
He asked. There was a couch that would make it easy to get to the elevator.
Oh, we'll figure that out later,
Elaine said.
Are you tired? Do you need a nap?
He shook his head. Elaine. Angel tugged at her mother's t-shirt. Can I show Daniel my room? Her room was much smaller than his, with light pink walls, a bed with a pink bedspread and a heart-shaped headboard, clothes thrown across the unmade sheets and toys littering the floor, stuffed animals stacked four deep. Dumming cleared a path through the center, pushing aside t-shirts and socks. Angel held up a small pink iPod and white headphones.
Want to listen?
They each took an earbud and sat on the floor. Music swelled into Dumming's right ear, a tinny electronic drum beat and a woman singing crunchy, processed vocals. Angel bobbed her chin.
When's your birthday?
November 8th.
I don't have a real birthday because I'm adopted, but we decided that my birthday could be March 15. When's your gotcha day?
What's gotcha day?
You don't know? All adopted kids have one. It's like a birthday, but not a birthday. It's the day that you went home to your forever family.
Gotcha sounded less fun than a birthday. More like he was being hunted. I'm not adopted yet. I'm a foster kid.
What's that?
It's like being adopted, but it's more temporary.
Dumming looked at Angel. Her skin was light brown, her nose wide and squashy. She had a missing tooth, one of the pointy ones. He took his Discman out from his backpack.
You like Hendrix?
Who?
Jimi Hendrix. He has a song with the same name as yours.
Dumming unplugged the earbuds and replaced her iPod with his Discman. He forwarded to Angel and pressed play. The guitar and cymbals shimmered in their ears, and he sang along.
Tomorrow I'm going to be by your side.
Then he got afraid that Angel might think he was singing to her, that he liked her. He hit stop.
You like it?
It's all right.
He's only, like, the greatest guitar player ever in the history of the universe.
She flipped open a container, exposing a yellowing plastic U.
Do you want to see my retainer? I have to wear it when I sleep. It's supposed to keep my teeth in place. It kind of hurts. I have too many teeth. I had to get one removed.
He was afraid she'd put the plastic U in her mouth, or even more terrifying, make him try it on. But she shut the container and tossed it onto the floor, where it landed on a stuffed parrot. Dumming wanted to tell Roland he had hung out with a girl. Make it sound cooler than it was. He had Roland's phone number on a piece of paper. He would call later and explain. He would have to do the same for Peter and Kay.
You should ask your parents about your gotcha day when you're adopted, Angel said. That way you'll get gifts. I got a CD from my friend Lily and a t-shirt from my other friend Lily. I have three friends named Lily and a friend named Jade. We're all adopted from China.
Dumming got up. From the window he could see the rooftops of smaller buildings, a woman watering plants, a couple sunbathing.
That's North, Angel said. Where the Empire State Building is. See that tall one over there?
I know what the Empire State Building is. And the Bronx. That's North, too.
He couldn't see the Bronx from where they were, but Angel's confirmation of what direction they were facing helped orient him. He had a plan.
The Bronx is far,
I used to live there.
With Peter and Kay?
Before I met them.
I thought you were born in China, like me.
I was born in Manhattan. I'm from here.
Angel's eyebrows were too close together. Sparse and dark and wiggly.
Deming grasped for the lost Mandarin words and lunged.
Did you think it was forever when you came here?
She bunched up her face.
I don't know Chinese.
Oh,
he said, crushed.
Kay insisted he hold her hand. It was his job to lead her through the city, to make sure she was okay. An old woman with a cane was overtaking them, and Deming tried to get Kay to walk faster. Peter lingered behind them.
Come on, Dad, he said.
Deming trudged on, a sour stench emanating from the garbage bags on the curb, and when he wasn't looking, he stepped into a smear of dog poop. He scraped his sneaker against the pavement. On the corner, a guy with a blonde ponytail was letting his dog pee all over the sidewalk. They were going to Chinatown for lunch, passing Chinese people who were following the paths from his face to Kay's hand to Kay and Peter's faces, from Angel's to Jim and Elaine's. Angel couldn't understand Chinese.
Kay, this is where they have the best cakes.
She pointed to a storefront that Deming didn't recognize. They couldn't be far from Rutgers Street.
There used to be a bubble tea place here, he said.
This is where I have Lion Dance, said Angel. My Sifu's name is Steve, and our troupe is called the Lotus Blossoms.
They're something, Elaine said. The Lion Dance and the Fan Dance, all the different dances, I can't keep track. It's so good for the kids to connect to their culture. That way they'll still know how to be Chinese.
Yes, it's so important, said Kay.
It's not too late to register Daniel for camp, Elaine said. It's the last week of August. It would be great for him. They have all kinds of cultural activities for the kids.
Email me the info. I've been meaning to ask you about it.
They passed a wet market with plastic buckets of crabs. Two ducks hung in a window, roasted brown and sticky with sauce. Peter took his camera out and fumbled with the settings. He aimed his lens, then frowned at the screen.
Hey, how about a family shot?
Jim said, taking the camera from Peter.
Angel ran in front of the window, hip stuck out into a pose.
Work it, Angel, work it!
Elaine said.
Come on, Wilkinsons!
They assembled on the sidewalk beneath the roast ducks and sweaty window, a man in a white apron hacking meat inside, as Elaine wrapped her arms around Angel, Peter and Kay's arms around Deming.
How do you use this thing?
Jim shouted, and Peter broke away to assist.
They passed the camera back and forth.
Okay. Smile, everyone. One, two, three.
Deming stood against Peter. People were staring. Jim pressed another button.
One more. Daniel, smile in this one. Come on, you're on vacation. Vacation is supposed to be fun.
Smile,
Elaine said. Deming forced a smile.
Cheese,
sang Angel. Kay pulled him closer.
It's okay, she whispered. You don't have to smile.
But he did. Glad that she was on his side. At a restaurant on Mott Street, the waiter gave them English menus, looking at Deming and Angel. He started to dole out chopsticks, then paused and pulled out silverware instead. On the table in front of Deming, he placed a glinting metal fork with a water stain on the handle.
Chopsticks for me, please,
Elaine said.
Me too, said Kay.
Chopsticks for all,
Jim said. The waiter put down chopsticks and took their orders, and as he walked away, Deming heard him talking to another waiter in Fujianese,
about moving tables together for a larger group of customers.